Welcome back to Shaping Logics. This is episode 12. We have Jose Parral today joining us. Jose was recently named the chair at Woodbury University in San Diego. All of us here at Shaping Logics have had Jose as an instructor at some point in our education, and so we were very excited to have him on the podcast. He walked us through his early career in landscape architecture, as well as his approach towards teaching studio classes. I was really glad that we got into a discussion about the future of the architecture profession and how architects are perceived by the public. Because to me at least, there seems to be an identity crisis within the profession, coming from recent graduates asking what we want out of a job in this field, but also asking what is the role of the architect in the future. Please enjoy this episode. Thank you for coming on, Jose. Usually I do the intros like afterwards, like the more formal, like, oh, Jose has been a teacher at Woodbury, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that's how, for the listeners, that's how we know Jose. He taught at Woodbury. I think we all took a class from with him, right?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
That was great. That was one of my favorite ones.
I think I did the 3A and then 4B.
Yeah,
he was a little more indirect. I think I had Renee, but somehow he was MIA.
because remember we were doing the three projects.
Right, yeah, so it's all
I don't know why we, like, it was just like too many balls in the air, and then I remember Renee was going to Oaxaca, then he was going, because he went with you guys to Oaxaca, right? And then there was somewhere else.
We went Guadalajara.
To Guadalajara, right, that's right. And so I was the one that had to... I was stuck in
San Diego. City Heights.
Yeah,
I remember that. Yeah.
So that was good. That was
a
good
studio.
That was a good studio.
That was my redemption semester.
So thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
No, it's so first off, what did you study? Where did you study, and how did you know that was what you wanted to study?
So I did my undergraduate at UC Berkeley, and I did it in landscape architecture. And, you know, I think just like all of us, like, I didn't really know. It kind of fell into place with me. Because when I graduated from high school, I barely graduated. Like, fortunately, I ended up going to a high school that allowed me to kind of, like, do the things I wanted to do. And at the same time, kind of encouraged me to be an adult, to kind of grow up, and because I wasn't growing up at all. And because of that, then right after high school, I didn't have the grades to go to university at all. But of course, I went to community. I was really excited about education at that moment, so I decided to go to community college, taking GEs, and I knew what I needed to take. And one of the goals was to become an astronomer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was like, oh, you know, look at this. You know, I was like such a romantic. I want to look at the stars and blah, blah, blah. But then I took my first astronomy course, and it was just all math. I'm like, oh, this is what it is? Like, forget. I thought I was going to be in a telescope looking at the stars. And that didn't work out. And so that's one trajectory, right? It's like this one path of like trying to discover what it was. And then I remember, not at the good high school, but at the bad high school, I took drafting courses. So I thought, oh, that's cool. Like drawing. I like drawing. And I didn't know what architecture was, but I just knew, because in the drafting courses, just like you draw a house. So I didn't know. You just kind of copied what the house was. But I liked the physical action of like drawing. It's like, oh, I want to do more. Like, is there a creative way of doing it? So that was one other seed. And then the final seed was, I think, from my dad. So he was a gardener. He would do a lot of houses in La Jolla. And he was he's almost like a celebrity. Like, at least maybe this is the way I remembered it. Because when we, you know, I'd be helping him out on the weekends, and I drive alongside him, and he'd be driving around the neighborhood, and everybody's like, Jose, hey, what's good? You know, and like literally like his clients, people walking down the street, he was like, wow, this guy's famous. And so he was a gardener. I would help him out. And he even, you know, when I was kind of considering what to do, he's like, well, there's this thing called landscape architecture that you can kind of do. It's like, it's kind of like what we do, but you kind of plan it out. You kind of like, he didn't really say design. I forgot what he said, but this notion of designing. So I think between those three things kind of developed my interest. Then going to, I don't know, maybe this is really boring, but then going through community college, I had to take, there was no landscape courses at that time. So I took, all the courses were architecture. So then I was like, wow, I was leaning towards architecture, but then my math was not good. So you can do, at that time, you can have a transfer over to UC Berkeley in the landscape program. And so that's what I did, and that's, it kind of just went from there.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah, I knew that you had gone to landscape architecture, but I didn't know the story about your dad and how that.
Yeah.
Which I can definitely, not me specifically, but I know a lot of the people that we talk to have either a parent or relative that was in construction or something like that, and then that's how they sort of made the jump, into architecture. Or
I think it was that, it was like this, I don't know how it is with everybody else, but it's just like this hands-on,
literally.
Me pulling as a kid, pulling weeds or planting a plant. Like I can go to La Jolla and there's a palm tree, and I show my kids, hey, I planted, it sounds really corny, but it's like, hey, I planted that palm tree. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's tall, and I remember when I planted it, it was like this small thing. And so it's like this weird, whether you're in construction or landscape, whatever, this is, for me, it's fundamentally, it's like you're changing the world. It's that little piece mm-hmm. of the world, but you're literally changing it. So like your ego kind of comes into it. Your I guess other, I don't know what other aspects, I guess it's the ego at the end, but like you realize that you're kind of making that mark. And so when I started to discover about design in that sense, it's like, wow, you're actually planning in a way to kind of change the world. I'm thinking about retrospectively. I think at that moment I was probably like, this is cool. I get to draw. Like I was really excited about that. I think the other end of it was, so that's the hands-on part. I think literally changing the world, and then, or the practical end. And then on the other side was, we were talking about a little bit earlier about music. That's always, so when I was in high school, I was in a band and I was in playing music, and that was a creative outlet. And so when I started to discover design, I realized how can I fold in that creativity of music into mm-hmm. that process as well. There's no direct connection, but just knowing that.
No, I agree with that, because I kind of have a similar story in the sense that, I too barely graduated from high school. And then I knew that I wanted to get educated. And then, of course, I had music at the time.
Yeah.
So I thought that, I should pursue the music thing. So I did go to music school. I went to community college, and I went to San Diego State for a semester. And then music became work. It was no longer about an idea of putting a song together, but it was about playing the right scales and the right notes within that scale. And it was very, it's not like architectural theory is very free in a sense.
Yeah.
Where in music theory are it's a guidebook. You follow that, and once you really learn it, then you can sometimes break it. And so I didn't like that, because then I realized that I liked the process of songwriting, which is, it was more free. You start setting rules, okay, what I want to talk about, how fast I want to put, do I want it to sound happy or sad?
Right.
And at the same time, I took a couple architectural courses, and design is essentially that. You start setting up these smaller rules that inform the design. And to me, I saw that as doing architecture is almost like running a song. And for me, it was that path that, okay, this is cool, because I can still do my music without having an education, and then have something that's very closely related to how I would write a song, but instead I'm doing design.
Right. So I mean, there's subtle differences, right?
For sure.
Because I think with music, it's, at least for me, it's a one-to-one thing, or it's an instant, right? It's
right.
As time goes on, you're making these changes right away, versus with the architecture, it seems like a much slower process where you're kind of planning it out. You're having discussions, you're pinning it up, it's almost like music, but it's at a slower pace.
Right, no, I agree.
And so for me, when I realized that, when I was taking courses, I was slower? Cool.
Right.
I can work faster and do but that was the other thing. When I was a student, I never did alternatives. I knew I had this one-to-one relationship, but I knew what I wanted to do in my mind and then how to apply it. which I think retrospectively is kind of a bad way to go about it. But I didn't know, and I was like, you know, I was just like so gung-ho and right. discovering it. So finding that relationship between music and design, I was just like, okay, if it's slower, I can be better now at design because I can move faster than the process of a typical, you know,
right.
assignment or whatever. So one example of that was like when I was at Berkeley. This is really awkward for me to say because I don't want to. It's not like I'm. I guess I'm bragging, but not trying not to. But at that time, I was like one of the top students in the landscape program. And I think a lot of it was because I had that training in architecture. And I think architecture gives you a little more discipline. So it was weird. I was able to work better, faster than this, what we're just saying now, this notion of music and tying it together. It's like, and my ego, it's like the combination of those things kind of made me do projects quicker, faster, and like a lot better than some of the other students. So I was taking two design studio courses when as an undergraduate because I just loved it so much. I mean, that's, I think the other thing too is because I went through community college, I took all my GEs. Mm-hmm. So then by the time I got to Berkeley, I was just doing all the design
stuff. The fun stuff.
All the fun stuff. And I was just like, it was so much fun. It was so, I look back and that was like a really good moment in my education. And it kind of showed, I guess, in a way. I don't know. It's funny how like your past begins to kind of inform those particular moments in your life. And that was definitely like a, going from a negative, like barely graduating from high school to like when I got and graduated from Berkeley, being one of the top students in my class. So that was a huge, huge, huge accomplishment personally for me to kind of do.
Definitely.
Two things that you mentioned that kind of stood out to me, and you say you didn't make a connection, but I totally saw the connection right there when you talked about your dad, kind of like, you know, that people look at him like you looked at them as a celebrity.
Yeah.
And and like the music, you know, like you're not trying to make, but I can totally see how like when you have a pretty landscape, it brings like happiness to people, you know. Yeah. So like I guess like the people that were hiring him, they were looking at him like as an artist, you know, like bringing happiness to their lives, you know, making it better. Because I've experienced some like really, really like shitty landscapes that just make you feel really bad, or like, you know, when you experience it, it just feels gloomy.
I think landscape sets a tone.
In my opinion. It's like it's right there, and it's like the first thing you see. It's like it's a mood that it sets you in. So
right.
I think making that connection of like the celebrity, I think it's right there. You know, the music. And the actual creative part of it, it goes one in one. I don't know. It's kind of hard to explain, but I can totally see it.
Yeah,
I see landscape like chords. You know, it's like, is it a minor chord? Is it a major chord?
Right.
And I'm serious. That's, you know, some people say they see things in color. I always see everything like in music. Like, how would that be translated into like a sound?
Yeah.
And then for me, landscape is that.
Yeah.
Like if a landscape like makes you feel happy, I was like, oh, that's a major chord.
But like, I don't know. Growing up in our family, like. Everybody, my dad, my sisters would like crank up the music. So like it was always like a movie. Like music was in my life was always in the background. So like so my dad, like on rainy days he couldn't work, so he'd be at home and he loved classical music, but he would crank it up. Like when he was home, everybody knew. Like it was just like loud. Or my sister on the weekends, I remember, you know, it's like, this was like late 70s, so it was like disco. So like disco was like cranked up, like full. So that was always like, I guess, it was always a part of, I think, our family, always about that. And I think maybe for me, that's why I kind of drew into design and kind of, not so much, I guess it is landscape because, it, you know, fundamentally it's about, you know, that connection of the work that I did with my dad. But I think also too, when it rolls into architecture, you know, there's in going to the theoretical and the kind of academic part, like everybody starts to talk about atmospheres in architecture. Uh-huh. And I think to me, fundamentally, it's trying to bring in those aspects of landscape into a space, an architectural space, right? Because you're trying to set a mood. Transit minor, major chord, And how do you do that with walls, doors, windows, right? How do you accomplish that? And I think in some ways that's way more difficult because the landscape is a lot more forgiving in that sense.
Yeah, for me, definitely. So what was your, so after, you know, you, after your experience with school, like what was your life after that? Did you have to, did you go to in the working environment or did you,
yeah,
did you want
to, and then to add to that too, like just going from this ideal and yeah. the kind of this romanticized idea of what landscape was during school, yeah. kind of get your shock of like going from that, you know, into the real world and like working in landscape architecture.
So get, this is the best part. This is like an amazing, and it just kind of took me to another path. So, you know, I don't know if you guys, but like right after I finished school, I'm like, I gotta work. I got like, I gotta yeah. pay the school loan. Like, and the other thing, we got married, me and my wife got married really young. So we're, you know, not that we're starting a family at that point, but it's like, you know, it's the two of us. And like, she wanted, she's like, okay, Jose, you did your school. It's my turn now. So you better find some work so that I can go to school. Fair enough. So, a lot of the faculty up there, I got to be really close to them, you know, just like with us. Mm-hmm. And I told them, like, I think I need to go back to San Diego. Why did we go back to San Diego? We could have stayed up there. I'm trying to remember. I think, you know, I think it's a Mexican thing where it's like, got to be really close to our family. So it's like, both of us, like, we got to go back to San Diego. We just need to be close to our families. Okay, let's do that. So we decided to go back. And I didn't know, like, because community college here, I didn't know, like, who were firms or who's famous or, mm-hmm. you know, I had no clue. So by the time I got to Berkeley and we were thinking about going to San Diego, I was like, how do I go to talk to?
Yeah, you had like no contacts here.
No
yeah.
contact. All the contacts were in the Bay Area. Yeah. So then I asked David Meyer, who was like a associate, who's an adjunct professor there at Berkeley. He's like, oh, I know someone, Marty Poirier, and they have a firm, landscape firm. Okay, yeah, I'll give it, you know, I'll send him an email. He's like, and then he's like, oh, you know, so I sent him, not, it wasn't even emails. It was like, at that time, I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, this is before.
I'm writing a letter.
I was writing a letter, right? Phone calls, like, hey, you know, I just graduated from Berkeley. He's like, yeah, no, I, you know, David told me some good things about you. Come on down, we'll interview you. Came down, well, we moved down at that point. Because no matter what, it was just like, I had to figure it out. Had the interview. They're like, okay, we'll try you out. I was like, oof, try me out. Like, because I don't know how to explain it. It's like, and maybe it's the same way now, but at that time it was really, they had to vet you. They had to really see if they're, you know, things kind of aligned. And even then, it was pretty difficult.
If you're a good fit.
Yeah, if we're a good fit. And so, you know, and they're really cautious. So Marty Poirier, at that time, the firm was called Spurlock Poirier. And so they've done, you know, and I've worked with some of the projects, like, for example, the Petco Park with Predoc. We did the, you know, I did the planting design for all the plants that was there. So that was amazing. It was an incredible opportunity and project. So, okay, here's like the funny, that transition of like reality. It's like, reality was suspended for just one project. And so the very first day I come into work, the first project I work on is the Getty Center Garden with Robert Irwin.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So you guys are familiar with that one?
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. So it was in the kind of design development, almost to construct. No, it was construction document phase. And so it was almost like this smooth continuation from school into practice, because it was like I was learning CAD. You know, that's when CAD just started coming out. So I was like, and at school, they didn't even teach us CAD. We did everything by hand. So I was learning how to use computers. But at the same time, the office was kind of open. So like, it's kind of like studios at Woodbury. So it's like, you know, you could hear what everybody else is doing. So I'd be working on something and then I could hear Andy Spurlock and Robert Irwin having conversations about the design. And it was just through that listening that it was like almost a continuation of my education. It was phenomenal. The budget was like, there was like endless. It's like they didn't like, Robert Irwin, what do you need? What do you want? Oh, you want to do that? Sure. You want to do this? It's like, you couldn't ask for a better project to work like as your first project. And then, you know, the budget was so huge. I remember it was on the construction phase. You know, we would fly a plane from San Diego to LA.
Wow.
To do site visits. It's like, what? Like, that would never. It was crazy. That would never happen. But it was just like this dream come true. So then I was like, oh my God, I just found.
It's real.
It's real. You could actually do that. And so then, but then I realized it was a very slow process because that one took a long time. So I'd always jump on and off it. And then I would be working on other projects that were bigger. And it was a really good, smooth transition to reality because that was like, you know, a dreamy, you know, once in a lifetime project. And then these other ones were kind of more realistic, but we were working with pretty good projects. It was like, you know, like the ballpark, like, it's kind of the landscape kind of died, but it was the Salvation Army. And that was one that I worked on that I really personally liked. It was the Salvation Army Community Center up in Rolando. Mm-hmm. So that one I worked on. And so this was like the dreamy design stuff. But then there was a part of me that was like the social, like, I think, and that's where landscape starts to come. It's like, how can public spaces be activated and be for the better good? You know, like, how can design actually be the advocate for good public community and space and all that good stuff? So, you know, as that was tailing off, then the reality of the projects were coming in. So it's like, how can I take that information from the earlier Robert Irwin Getty Center project and begin to kind of incorporate it into like the everyday projects that were there? It was a great, smooth, like, fortunate. I think it was just a roll of the dice that happened. So that was nice.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. But then after that, it kind of, you know, then after that transition is just, then it got into reality and just like dealing with the everyday, like, you know, usual, you know, projects and clients and stuff and, you know, the whole mess.
So what was the transition like to like you going to like teaching and getting involved in academics?
Yeah. So like I was saying earlier, when I got out of graduate school, it's so weird. Now I look back at
Where did you go to graduate
school? So I went to the Architectural Association. And so here to continue my story with Spurlock Poirier. So at that time at Spurlock Poirier, I was working at the Getty Center. Like at the same time I got hired, they hired this new kid who just graduated from the Architectural Association, and he was going to help with the Getty Center Garden. So I go walk. He comes, and he's all dressed in black. And it's like in the middle of the summer. It's in the middle of the summer, and he's wearing a coat, all black. Black rimmed glasses.
Just walked out of the airplane.
He just walked out of the airplane out of London, and he's like, who are you? Like, you literally like looking. I'm like, wow, who's this guy? He's like, he just looks like an architect, right? Already, he's like, wow, he's got it nailed. So we worked together, and you know, we introduced ourselves. Like, hey, my name's Jose. My name's Rene Peralta. So within the next, it was a year that I was working there. So within that year, we got to be really good friends. And then at that time, my wife Tassi decided she wanted to go to SciArc to study architecture. So then we moved to SciArc. She was there for a year. She realized like, you know what? Like, architecture's not for me. I want to do art. Cool. Move back. I get to work at Spurlock again. Renee is still there because the Gettys, I think it was just finishing up at that time. And so she finishes school and I'm like, okay, now it's my turn. Right now I want to go back to school. And then at that time, you know, you hear Renee in the background of me working. He's like, Jose, Architectural Association, architecture, you need to go there. You have to go there. And I'm like, really? Yeah. And so then he shows me. So there wasn't even websites at that moment. It was just like these books, prospectus that he brought with him. And he showed me, he's like, look at the work. Look at what I did. You know, he was like totally marketing for the program. And so he brainwashed me. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go there. So I applied to the AA and I applied to the Barlett. And I got accepted to both of them. And so I had this dilemma. I was like, which one should I go? And I just rolled the dice. And I was like, okay, I'll just go to the AA. I knew I needed to get... I think the other thing, too, is like... Because I grew up in San Diego and I had that experience at Berkeley, it's like I had to go somewhere else. I had to, like, leave mm-hmm. San Diego personally. And I think Tasi, not so much. And she did, too. I think she did, too. But not so much. So then we went to... London. I went to school at the AA. So the other part, you get this education. And the problem with the AA for me, now looking back, is that it was a very strong dogma. Like, it was a very specific way of teaching and learning. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a fanatic religion, right? So when you come out of it, you're like completely brainwashed. You come with a new language, you know, that we talked about before. You come up with this new philosophy and a way to approach it. So I was like, okay, I'm ready to spread the gospel of this new whatever, this idea to anybody and everybody. So like, what was it? So I come back, I go to Tijuana, I go, the first person I see is Renee. We have an argument and I won the argument. Usually I lose. Like with Renee, I usually lose. But I remember this one time I beat him, and he's like, Jose, see, I told you, that's the reason why you went to the AA. Good like the job. Yeah, yeah, the final test. He's like, you passed. Like, that was
still gave himself some kind of credit for your winning.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like, okay, good. Whew. But it's like you had this information, this energy that you wanted to share. And so how I got into teaching was at Woodbury. No, first it was actually at New School because Renee was teaching a course there. And so, this is really funny. So I was working at Spurlock and then I asked them, can I, you know, teach a course with Renee? No, we need you full time. How can you be teaching? Blah, 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 blah. Okay. So then I was working on this, designing a bench. And I was super articulate. I did all these designs. But of course, I was like in my own mind. I was doing it. And then I presented it to Andy, and Andy's all, oh, what? Like, that's not what I asked you to do. I wanted it to be like this. But then when he was doing it, I think he felt really bad because he knew I put a lot of energy and effort into it. And so then I knew that. So then I asked him again. I'm all, hey, can I, you know, I'll make sure I make up the time, but can I teach from like 4 to 6? Or it was leave early 2 days a week. And so because he felt bad, he's like, okay, Jose, like, oh, you can do it. So that was the only way. So I was a TA for Renee. Wow. So that was like 2003, 2004. And so that was the fall. And then I think it was either a year later or at the end of that semester, a friend of mine. So this is what's good about school is that you get all these connections. So mm-hmm. a friend of mine from Mexico City asked me, hey, there's this thing called Insight. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. It happened like 10 years ago. And they want to interview you as an artist. I'm like, what? As a potential artist. I'm like, I'm not an artist. So, but yeah, let's do it. So I interviewed with the curator, Osvaldo, is it Sanchez? I think it's Sanchez. He's a Cuban. He's a guy from Cuba. He's a curator that lived in Mexico City. He still lives in Mexico City now. And he interviewed me. He's like, yeah, I want you to team up with an artist from Mexico City. And he was always about this idea about gardens. It was like, awesome. Like, you know, it's like, you know, it's like everything was kind of melding, mm-hmm. you know, art, architecture, my gardening interests. This is like my moment. And so for Insight, there's a lot of famous artists, really famous artists that went through it, but it's a very brutal process. So because of that, the word got around about me, this person that's like an artist, architect, whatever. And so Teddy, and I've known Teddy for a while too. So then, because when I worked at Spurlock, his office was right across the hallway. Teddy Cruz, yeah. And so Teddy's like, hey, do you want to teach at Woodbury? Because he was teaching there at the time. I'm like, yeah, yeah, of course. Like, I'm just ready to, like, God, I was so ambitious then. And he's like, okay, you can teach a studio course, but you're going to teach it with the anthropologist. I'm like, what? I want to teach my own course. Like, what are you doing? Like, what's that? So I teamed up with an anthropologist. Her name is Fiamma Montemonzuma. And she comes from Italy, and she has a long, like, she comes from royalty, from Italian royalty. But she's like the rebel princess. And so she kind of like, eh. She left Rome, moved to Mexico, and became an anthropologist there. So you're going to be doing something with her. Okay. We were complete opposites. She was, you know, romantic, you know, romanticizing theory. You know, it was about, like, the people and all that stuff. And by the time I went to the AA, I was brainwashed. And I was like, no, it's about systems, you know, like, parametric, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, well, what do you mean? You know, Deleuze. And she's like, Deleuze, no. So we were totally clashing the whole time. But she didn't know design. So I knew design. So I was, like, teaching them the design. But she was kind of giving them... Like, really, Jose? Like, no. It should be like, you know, so we were always in clash and butting heads. And what resulted was kind of like, looking back, was probably one of the best courses that ever happened at a Woodbury. Like, this contradictions and clashes and whatever resulted in, like, for the students, a kind of like huge spectrum of views just between two people. So I think maybe I'm wrong, but at least for the students, I thought ended up being a really good thing. And then we ended up being really, you know, we were fighting each other, but in the end, we ended up being really good friends. So the thing that, the art project, mm-hmm. about the giant model that was done, that was with Fiamma. Huh. So we've been friends ever since. And now she's an anthropologist and an artist in the Bay Area. So she was able to kind of do those things there. So anyways, it's just weird nets and... lines that kind of happened. So that was my first kind of transition into teaching, and then I loved it, and then I from that point on I kind of kept doing it in some form or manner. So
at that time you were working and teaching as well?
Yeah, I had to.
Wow,
that was the only way I could do it, because for adjunct faculty you don't get paid that much.
Yeah,
and so work is your meat and potatoes, and teaching is actually just the fun stuff. And
yeah.
Wow, you get a little extra money too.
Yeah.
So then I get to buy something or whatever, you know, pay an extra bill or something like that. But you had like this energy or this urge that you had. I had to kind of just like share it with other people.
Yeah. Do you think that's important that you kind of are practicing and teaching at the same time, or do you think, or at least do you have to like pay your dues and like you did, you were working and teaching and then kind of move on to a more full-time position or dedicate your full time at teaching? Do you think that's important for architecture?
Well, yeah, that's a weird question. And it's like, it's personally, it's been very, right now, it's been really difficult to kind of have a practice and mm-hmm. be teaching at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think, some institutions are very successful and supportive of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think our institution, not so much. So it's a really, it's weird. It's like you're still struggling.
Yeah.
But now it's like on the opposite end. You know, now I have a stable, you know, stable job, uh-huh. teaching, but now I want to have projects of practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, it's mostly art that I've been doing now.
But it's also, you know, I imagine the projects you have now that are outside of school are independent. You know, they're where you're not, you know, like when you started teaching, you were still, like you said, you had to ask, you know, for permission from right. your employer to take time off or whatever it is. And then, but like, yeah, I'm just imagining, but the like other professor's situation was similar where they, you know, they had their own projects that were on their own time. You know, if if they had to teach a morning class, like, sure, they, if, you know, they had to, they had time afterwards to work on their own stuff.
Right. It says, you know, and then there's conflict of interest because you're kind of like moonlighting and all that other stuff. And the only difficulty, and I think it's a cultural thing too, with institutions, is that typically when you're in academia, you know, you should be writing papers, you should be at conferences. That's the way that they measure how you are performing for a lot of the disciplines. In architecture, practices actually can be considered like a critical research as well, and development for yourself. So within architecture, yeah, it totally makes sense. But the moment that you start to talk to someone else that's in history department or in the math department, they're like, "What? Who cares? You built stuff. But have you written anything? Right? What have you written? And yeah, what have you presented?" Looking at
it from the perspective of like the teacher, but yeah, the school also has academia to, level, right? Yeah, the school has to get something from the teacher other than just.
It sounds like we're like a subcategory within the bigger umbrella.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I mean, and that was a learning. Again, that was a learning. Something that I going through and teaching now full time, that was something that I kind of realized. So it's hard because like, how do you balance, you know, all the requirements that you do at a university teach? It's not just teaching, but you're in committees, you have to do recruiting. You're attending all these meetings. And like, for me, it's like teaching, and I don't think it matters whether you're architecture at a university or teaching preschool. It's teaching is always, it's something that you can, at least for me, you can't just shut off and like take a break. It's like always in your mind and it's always in the background. You're always trying to, how can I do this better? How can I change this? Or man, this student was just a pain in the butt. Like, why did he, you know, just like affects you or whatever. Or this student was really great, and so it really, it kind of affects you mentally. So for me, it never goes away. And so to kind of, I have to learn how to cut it off and make it so that I can balance that practice part as well. And that's just something that I just need to kind of work on personally. It's hard. It's really hard for me.
And that's a really interesting point, at least for us, because I didn't know that. Because we focus so much, so heavily on the architecture that we think architecture professors are just like, okay, if we focus on the building, you know, like they're building something or they're doing practice. So I could never imagine that as an institution, you have to also pay your dues somewhere else, like writing papers and
it's also conference. Different than the delusion of like thinking that architecture of real world is going to be what you're doing in school.
Yeah.
We look at it just like teaching is like the perfect gig. Like you get to teach and like be
yeah,
theoretical and be
yeah,
active.
Yeah, that's what
and,
I
and then, you can go work and do your own side work. It's like perfect.
Yeah.
But yeah, I never imagined you had to, you know, be in all the, and make, totally makes sense.
Yeah,
but
that just sounds like work.
It does. I mean, it's a job. And so there's part of it that it is, you, exactly. That was I think the other part that I was interested about teaching, like I romanticized about it. It's like, right? Like that was the dream. I could practice, I can teach and I can do these two things. And it would, on one end, the theoretical end would push me further. That would reflect back in practice and vice versa. It's all a theory. And I think a lot of people have been able to manage to bridge those two things together. I'm still trying to figure it out. Yeah. It's not as easy as you think.
Because even with us, like, yeah, going from school to working, we're like, man, this sucks. I guess like the only way you can really like practice what you did in school is to do your own projects.
Yeah.
And then we did that, and then it was fun while you're designing it. But then after that, everything else is just hard work. And I'm like, I guess it's just like a never ending circle. You know, I guess you just want to be the guy that just draws it up and just hands it off to somebody else. And like, I'm done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, it's been such a roller coaster.
Yeah. Where we try competitions as well. And it becomes like,
competitions are good. Cause like you get to not, especially I feel like for us, like we're getting so stale in the sense that we're like looking at the code, looking at how do you draw this detail? How do you make the detail better? That you tend to kind of put all those books on the back burner. I can't remember the last time I picked up like an architectural book and just like glanced at it, you know? So competitions were a great way to kind of, you know, revive that kind of the thinker in
you.
And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember getting out of school and like, I think with Renee, I probably did 3, 4, 5 competitions together. And then when I graduated from the AA, what was nice is it was a small cohort. It was like 11 of us. And we did competitions all over the world. Because the thing about the AA is like people from all over the world go there. And then we all split up and we all did that. So then we did competition in Australia, Mexico City, here in the United States. And that was you're right. That was the outlet, you know, the creative outlet that was there. And what was nice about that too is that then you're kind of constructing your portfolio.
Right.
So that when you do have the client, you're like, this is what I do. And they're like, it's either like, wow, that's so amazing, or like, I just want you to remodel my house. Like, you know, right. I don't care like right, what you've done or whatever, but it's a good gauge. Like, maybe I don't want to work with you then. That's right. I'm not really interested in remodeling your house. I'm interested in these things that I've done. It's tough.
At what point, that's an interesting topic, at least for us, because you get to be selective, I guess, in that. Because at some point, like we said, like this year, you know, we kind of like, we were lucky enough to get a couple of gigs on our own, you know, after school. We said we want to set up our own office eventually, you know.
Yeah.
So we'd been moonlighting since then. but... We sort of got cocky after we got a good project, you know?
I feel like we just got lucky with, like, our first client that they kind of just let us have liberty of whatever we wanted to do.
That's nice.
You know, and even then, we kind of kept it simple, but we felt that for what it was, like, we felt like there was design flair incorporated into it.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so then we got cocky.
Yeah, then I'm saying, like, you know, after that we kind of figured, you know, we kind of have to take where it comes, you know, in order to build, because architecture is so much word of mouth. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not something you can really market a lot. It's not something, it's almost like your work speaks for you and you have to do something,
right?
So we sort of came to the conclusion, you know, like, just this year we kind of have to take on more projects, smaller projects.
Yeah, we just lost a lot of commissions, potential commissions last year because
we're being more selective. Like, yeah, I don't want to do that, you know. But what point, or like,
I had that. mine is like, it's weird. I don't advertise. I don't do anything.
Yeah.
But like you said, it's word of mouth, and then people come to me. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
It's going to cost you this much. You know, and it's like, oh, but you teach at a school. Don't you do it because you love it? Like, no, you know, this is a profession. You know, you're paying for my expertise.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to have to charge you. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's like, so I've had a lot of those.
Okay.
And then sometimes we align, and so I bring in this academic end to like a very practical project. So I did a hotel probably like 4 years ago, a remodel hotel, and I did the landscaping for it. And I fought the owner, but he hired me. He's like, with the knowledge, like, okay, you're going to tell me more than what I know. And he knows design really well. That was the fun part. It's like, he knew we would have these really good conversations. And so when the battles came with the contractor, like, no, why are you challenging me on the steps? I don't get it. Why you want to have steps going as a pyramid in two directions? It's the main entrance to get into, you know, the units over here. He's all, it's just the way you're wasting money, blah, blah. You know, they use the money argument. But the client was like, no. I hired Jose for this reason. You have to figure it out how to do it. I think there's you know, it was a detail issue because it was issues related to grade change. But it's like, you guys can do it. Like, don't, like, and I'd show drawings, I'd go on the site, et cetera, et cetera. And it ended up being a really, it wasn't like a, you know, like a completely fantastic project, but it was a pretty good project. At least a project that I could put on a portfolio and say I was proud of.
Yeah. Right.
Because I've had a bunch of them. It's like, I don't even want to show. Like,
that's where we're coming from. Like, last year, we're like, we don't want to like take on this job because then this person's going to refer us to other people that want to do this type of work. And we don't want to get caught up in that circle.
Yeah.
But then this year, we're like, man, we got to pay off our debt. So maybe we should stop being so selective and like just take in whatever we can. And
so I think that's for me, from what I understand, that's the Frank Gehry model. So the way he worked was that it was almost like he had two separate offices. One was like the office where he would just get stuff done, work for developers, did apartment buildings, whatever. And then that provided him money and time
and cushion
to kind of do his own research. And so he was working for the Santa Monica, you know, the Fifth Street Promenade. He designed a parking structure for the developer.
Wow.
And he invited the developer to his house. And you know how he was reworking his house. Yeah. He's like, wow, like, what are you doing? Like, this is like, this is really cool. And he's like, I would never thought architecture could be this way. Why don't we, you know, the next project, why don't you take some of those ideas and kind of incorporate it into that? And so that, I think that's good. I think you should probably take those jobs. But maybe it's like, you're not going to put in your portfolio. Yeah. You're just going to do them.
Yeah.
But there might be a moment where it's like, you might want to show the same client or someone else, like, hey, these are things that I'm interested in. And you never know. They might actually say, wow, I didn't know you could actually do that.
Yeah.
Right. Let's just work the next project. I
never really thought about that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and so I think I'm not saying that he knows this or that he claims this, but this is just my observation. I think he still does that, right? Because he has Gary Technologies. Uh-huh. And that's just, he farms out his CATIA stuff to all the firms, Zaha, you know, Morphosis. And he's probably making more money off of that.
Yeah, than the actual architecture.
The actual architectural practice that he has. And he makes a ton off his practice now. So I think my, that's something that I've always wanted to do, is like, I don't want to refuse anybody, but you got to pay me at least.
Yeah, that's where I was getting at. I mean, I guess, where I was getting, it's like, you get to be selective, but I guess you're not taking work, but yeah, we actually want to get paid.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
I know that's another thing that's a topic on its own.
Conversation, because you can have all these projects, but if you're not getting paid for them, or
and at what point you stop doing work for free, you know, like, cause even I'm not for free, but at least like you end up, because for us, you know, even taking on a little project, you could end up working for long hours on it, and you end up making like less than minimum wage. And
it's like a dollar amount to the hour.
Yeah, it becomes really weird.
It's really difficult, and I think, you know, like, oh, could you just put an addition to my house?
Yeah.
It's like, really, you want that? You want me to process it through the city and deal with all that? It's a time.
It's a lot, yeah, it's a lot of work. That's like another like learning lesson that we went through. Just like, one, not knowing how to charge, because nobody talks about that.
Yeah.
How fucked up the AA contract actually is.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like, yeah, let me do all the work up front and get the least amount of a retainer.
Yep.
You know, so it's like, if shit goes south, like, you still did all the work.
Yep.
Oh man, just a lot of learning.
Yeah. So do you guys think that should be in a, you know, like, an important part of your education as an architect?
That was like a question. That was question I had for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely think, I mean, at least we think so for sure. I know like architecture school is heavily in design, but I feel like they don't prepare you enough for, you know, even like being like an entrepreneur, like,
yeah, if I, you want to open the most important part, the entrepreneurial
like spirit,
aspect,
you know,
of it.
Yeah, you come on, like, you know, you know, like, even being with like Marcel or whatever, you were like, you learn how to work like super fast and like
how to produce,
and you know, and like, but you don't, like Hector saying, you don't talk about we don't talk about the money,
no.
We don't talk about clients, we don't talk about the business aspect of it, how to run an office, or, I mean, I know it's a lot, but I mean, at least like touch on it so it can spark a little bit of interest in the student.
Because I think also in general, like, just even like the AA community, there isn't enough resources out there to just even guide you to, like, you know, it's like, you're not going to go up to somebody like, hey, so like, how much do I charge for this? How much do you charge? Like, people don't like to talk about that.
I know. I always go to Catherine. I'm all, Catherine, hey, so I'm working on this project. Like, how much do you charge for this? She's like, well, Seth, that's too much. Like, why are you charging them that? I'm like, I have no idea. I'm just like
throwing stuff out there.
Throwing stuff. I'm just like, I'm using, like, this is what I shouldn't say this, but it's like, I use spreadsheets from where I worked before.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. their contracts. I use that as a template, but I haven't worked at a firm in like over 10 years. So I don't know, you know, I'm literally using the same numbers. And then when I go to Catherine, she's like, they're too high.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, that was 10 years ago. Didn't, you know, with inflation, like, shipping went up and all that. But then I'm realizing it's like, I was working at, you know, boutique firms or high-end firms or big companies where the overhead is so high.
Right.
So it's a learning, you know, I learned through mistakes, and that was, you know, that's the way I've been kind of learning. But this is the reason why I asked that question, is because this is what I was thinking of. I went to OCC And it blew my mind because they already got these robots. You know, they got a huge grant. They got robots. Wow. They got this milling steel fabrication machine.
Wow.
So, it, you know, you just plug in your Rivet model and it's going to do all the steel framing. Just like print it, not print it out, but construct it for you. They're working, they're aligning themselves with the prefabricated manufacturer. So you could, again, you could send your Rivet files. It's no longer like on their terms. Like literally you could send your Rivet file to them. They'll construct buildings, not just houses. Prefabricated, they'll just ship it, construct it that way. So for me, it like it in a weird way, I don't know, this is a question for me. Like it kind of just frees up. If all these things are happening to become automated, what does that mean for the profession? Right? Like is it going to be in the same trajectory that it has been for the past 100 years, 50 years, you know, 20 years? Or is it like, is it truly this paradigm shift?
Yeah.
Where like you get out of, you don't have to go to university anymore. You can go to community college and literally you can build things.
Yeah.
Right? Computers.
But somebody has to design it, right?
Somebody has to design it. So I think the education of designing, that's there. But maybe when you graduate, you don't work at a firm anymore. Mm. Maybe when you graduate, you just start your own business.
Yeah.
Right? And so then it got me thinking, like, yeah, maybe we do. I don't know. I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but
yeah,
maybe you do incorporate. How do you begin to start your own business so that by the time you graduate, not that you know everything,
yeah,
but at least you have some idea versus exactly. Like you're completely blind.
Yeah. No, I think it's like we were just also talking about that point where like being a little bit naive about taking on our own projects was kind of a blessing, because had we known the exact roadblocks and the exact challenges, we'd be like, no thanks.
Yeah.
But now we did it once. We're like, okay, now we can do it again because now we have like a template. We have like a strategy. Sure. So not knowing all the ins and outs. I mean, of course, knowing how to construct a building and put a set of documents together for sure.
Yeah.
But beyond that point, I think that's all you really need to know how to do. You can figure out everything else, you know?
Yeah.
You can, but I think, I guess, I don't know, would the education then encourage you to be that entrepreneur or more people to do it versus like, you know, certain people to kind of just become entrepreneurs? Because I did the same thing. I had no idea doing my first project on my own. How do I charge? What, you know, what's the overhead? Do I need to get insurance? I probably should, but I'm not. Yeah. You know, so it's like all these kind of questions that come up that you learn, you know, by doing. But maybe there's a way that you could at least get some of that knowledge.
I think it should definitely be introduced, you know, because when you're in there, you kind of have the mentality of like, oh, like what big firm can I go work for? Yeah. Or like, where can I go like get, you know, like all this knowledge? But if or I'm not even thinking about running my own firm, you know, you kind of have to be ambitious or like seek it out for yourself.
Yeah.
But if somebody would have introduced it to me, maybe in like first, second year, I would have been like, that's what I want to do, you know, and I just want to, you know, maybe like from now on, I'm gonna gear my, you know, educational career towards that.
Right.
That's the end goal, you know?
Right.
What do I need to do? Get licensed, do this or that? How do I take some extra business classes at our community, you know, like maybe something that in that aspect, because yeah, we didn't know anything. And
I think it's also just getting to a point where there's so many branches afterwards that like what is an architecture education supposed to teach you if there's all these, like, you can go into MRED, you can go do installations, you can do, you know, you can become just like a fashion designer, you can, you know, get into like
interior design, yeah.
You can do like the traditional route of, you know, staying at a firm for 2-3 years, then going to a bigger one,
yeah.
And then maybe another bigger one, and then
fabrication.
Well, do you think that that new implementation of like the NCARB kind of fast tracking students getting licensed right after graduating? You think maybe that's like the beginning of kind of what we're talking about now?
I think it's a reaction to what's happening in the world. This is just me. I don't know if I'm right or wrong. I think it's AIA, NCARB. They're reacting to kind of how things are changing. I think Catherine was the one that told me that we're in AIA, there's not very many licensed architects. A lot of them are retiring or passing away, but incoming ones has not been as intense as it has been in the past. So I think it's an initiative to kind of encourage people that are in architecture schools
to get licensed.
Yeah. But this is just me. My critique is that I think the whole profession, I think AIA, I shouldn't be saying this, but AIA should be questioning, like, how is it functioning as an organization that's been around, I don't know, 100 years, 150 years? Mm-hmm. I think it needs to kind of change and adapt. How and what? I'm still trying to figure it out, but I think if the profession doesn't change, engineering or product designers or Etsy is going to change it for us.
Yeah,
right.
You know, because I could totally see on Etsy, I go online, and there's going to be someone that's like, I can design your house and construct it for you. I got all the tools, laser printers, milling machines, robots. I'll just come to your place, build it for you.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. It's just, I think that's the world that we're going to be facing in the future, soon. Right. I think it's going to be pretty soon.
I think it's getting to... Because we've talked about this, you know, a lot, basically. But part of it is also this idea that architects are for, like, the 1%. The 1% of the 1%. And everybody else just deals with buying what's on the market or doing some, like, remodel or whatever with their contractor friend. There's some, you know... I think it's a good thing for those, if there are going to be those type of like Etsy, Pinterest that are like, it's a model that you go in, it's like the IKEA model, you know, go in, you like pick out your colors and the arrangement that you want and it gets delivered or, you know, whatever it is, whatever method of delivery it is. It's directly, there is no architect. It's just like a kit of parts and it gets installed.
Yeah.
I feel like we need to get into that K-12 system, you know? I'm serious too. There's a couple of programs. I feel like when you were in school, like you always hear, like, oh, what do you want to be, a doctor, a policeman? You have doctors coming to school, talk to you and police, but nobody wants to be an architect when you're like in second grade.
No.
And I feel like maybe introducing that and talking about it more, I think we do a poor job at like advertising just the profession itself in general with the, you know, younger generation.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, I think, but I think it's specifically with the United States.
Yes.
Like you go to Mexico or you go to Europe.
That's true.
And everybody knows, you know, like you go to Mexico and it's like, everybody knows Luis Barragan. Like,
yeah.
You know, they kind of like,
true.
That's true.
You know, yeah, every kid knows about it. You go to Spain and like, I remember in Barcelona, it's like, everybody was into design and aesthetics of design.
Yeah.
Like you walk down the street and you could have a conversation.
Like it's part of the culture almost.
It was part of it.
Embedded.
And then for us,
I think it's also because it's like those countries have a very unified idea of their aesthetic of like that.
True.
There's a history, you know, and whereas in the US, there's not really, there is no like, I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright, that's about it. American, right. You know, like.
Yeah,
it's true. But I think it's also the result of we are the leaders in the kind of making of massive, generic, you know, I don't know, like urbanism or architecture or like infrastructure. Like, I think it's so overwhelming. It's just, it doesn't become important. Like, architecture is not important. Right? It's like my phone's way more important than my house. It's like, yeah, make sure that that's designed well. So, I don't know. I think that's just things that I'm questioning about the profession and like how that will change. I think, so one is the IKEA model, but I think the other one is the Etsy model where it's like you go online and, you know, you see what people are doing, you see their portfolios, and then from there, you pick and choose who you want to design with, which would be the other one, because they have the tools that would construct, or they have the resources in which they can kind of build the house for you.
But who's to say that you can't be, you know, like, you know, you go to architecture school and then you become an Etsy architect, you know? I mean, that's another model too. That's another like branch, like Abel was talking about.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that's what I think what I'm trying to say is that I think in the near future, this is just me speculating. I could be wrong, but I think in the near future, if the profession is going in this traditional route, I think it's going to be sideswiped by this technology.
Yeah.
It's just purely technology. It's not even an education system, because even the education system is a little bit backwards. It's just going to take over.
Yeah.
You know, other people are taking over the profession, I guess. That's what I'm trying to say.
And it's not even like, because one thing that I've kind of, I was reading this book called Program or Be Programmed, and it's all about just how the programs that we use talk, meaning like software, you know, like Illustrator, Photoshop, they all have not like an agenda, but, you know, really the person that built that program is the one that basically tells you how to use their program.
Yeah.
And really like the thesis of that book is that like we should all be programmers, basically. But yeah, like that, any of those models of like the Pinterest or whatever it is, even if you are an architect and you're in this platform, it's going to be limited by the framework of that. You know, it's like we use Squarespace for our website, and yeah, it's limited to what we can do. You know?
Yeah, it's like when you're in school and you can tell it's a Revit model, or you can tell it's a SketchUp model, or you can tell it's a Rhino model, because you're kind of limited to those set of rules that the software provides you, I guess. Yeah. Is that where you're getting at?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I just, and I think right now, from what I understand, enrollment in general in architecture has been going down.
Why do you think that is?
I think part of it's a cultural thing. I think the other part is that of it is that right now the market's kind of good, so everybody's working. Mm-hmm. So that's a typical trend. If the economy's good, people are working, they're not going to go back to school. So that's generalizing. But like I remember, I was recruiting, high school recruiting, you know, architecture, Woodbury.
Like recently, or
this is probably like 2 years ago, and so then this mom, her kid was there. Then the kid runs off. The mom comes to me. She's like, "Well, so what programs do you guys have?" We only have architecture. And she looks at me. She goes, turns and walks away. And I was like, for me, it was like, that was the realization. It's like, that's what I think in general people think of that profession. It's like, why?
But it's also like, right now, it's, you know, who are the billionaires? It's all the Amazon, Google, Facebook. It's all tech related. You know, it's all computer scientists. It's not anybody, it's no longer, those are like the career celebrities, you know. Even I would argue that like those have been overtaken. They've overtaken the spots of like doctors, firefighters. Maybe in like a 2-year-old's mind, like no, because they're, you know, they have the idea of like police or whatever. But when it gets to reality of like what is a student, a recent high school grad is gonna. What they're interested in, or what they're going to be.
But I think fundamentally it's like aesthetics.
Yeah.
Is not incorporated early on. Mm-hmm. It's always like the math and the sciences. Music is, you know, getting out of the school system. Like you can't really play music anymore. Some schools have art. Other schools don't. So it's like this whole notion of creativity. The other end of the spectrum, we're always focusing on kind of the science and the math.
So. Yeah, I think you're right. A lot of it has to do with culture, because the American mentality is almost like who cares what it looks like as long as it works at the end, you know? Like, that's a very, very constant mentality amongst, you know, I guess the blue collar, like Abel was saying, like the elite people, obviously, you know, when they're going to build a house, that's when they care, you know, but
yeah, but it, oh, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, but and even then sometimes they don't that much, you know. But yeah, I know exactly what you're what you're saying.
And I think I don't know, I shouldn't be saying this too, but I think the other thing is who our president is, right? He's not a he's not a doctor, he's not a lawyer. Yeah. He's a developer.
Yeah.
And so I think
his suits are like three times the size that they
need. Yeah. So I think, you know, I just remember working at firms and I'd be working for developers and they had this kind of like this Trump mentality. This was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, totally. It's like the same things that I see that he's doing, same things those guys are treating me. And I was like, I would laugh in their face. Like, really, you're going to yell at me because it was your fault? You know, it's like, whatever, you know. So I think we're also in a kind of moment in the history of this country where it's an architect is not cool, but a developer is. Mm-hmm. For better, for even if you don't like the president, I think that it's still almost subconsciously there, right? It's the structure has been set.
Yeah, that sort of winner mentality of like just
right, because in theory, in the kind of image of him, he makes whatever he can. He's the developer, right? Not the architect's just my hand.
Yeah,
to make it happen.
It's my employee.
My employee, like everyone else. And so versus like you go again to like Spain, it's like they know and appreciate the role of the architect.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, I guess that's getting into another conversation. Sorry. No, but I'm saying like I think you're totally right, and this is kind of like the model that we eventually, at least I want to get to, where we talked about, we had Jeremy on the podcast, but kind of like being your own developer, you know, architect as developer.
Yeah.
Because you're totally right. Like in America, that's the mentality. That's the only way they're gonna you're gonna be able to sort of
make it in this world. Like better or for worse, you know, it's kind of a sad truth, but it's like, if you don't have control of everything, then you have no control.
It's like, it's shifting the power from the developer to the architect.
Right. Basically. Right. And so, anyways, that's why I was thinking, like, not that education becomes more theoretical, but like, how does you take some resource that really practical, basic entrepreneurial things, and how does that get incorporated into everything else?
Yeah,
teaching. Anyway, so those are things that I'm thinking.
I mean, also another thing that you mentioned about, just this is a little going back to where the mom walked away. It's also about like what Hector was saying. It's like the marketing of architecture. Like, for example, say if she's like, "What do you guys offer at your school? Did you say architecture?" You know, I would say like, I would try to sell it as like, you can do like set design, you can do like production, you can do, you know, like product design, you can do a lot of things with it, you know, like that's what people don't understand. Like, I get frustrated sometimes when I talk to people and tell them what I do, and they say like, "Oh, so you just do blueprints, you know, or like you just and it's like no, there's so many branches off of the profession, and it's kind of hard and frustrating.
We do podcasts.
but like for me, like that education makes me a better like thinker.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Right? Like, so it doesn't even have to be about design. It's just like, you know, looking at a problem in different ways rather than just, you know, the most efficient way to kind of do it.
No, I mean, I've always said like architecture just ruined my life.
Yeah.
In the sense of like, I can't look at anything as simple as watching a movie without making connections. I was like, oh, that's totally wrong. Like, what they should have done, or like, there's a scene, right? And the person's like broke, but there's an Eames chair in the scene because, you know, whoever set up that scene is a designer. Yeah. So they wanted to get that Eames chair, and I was like, that doesn't make any sense for the, you know? So I can't just look at anything anymore and be like, not, you know, critique it for one reason or another.
Right. So it's so funny you said that, because what was it, a couple nights ago we were watching Narcos. Uh-huh. And so there's one scene where they're trying to, you know, talk to the government to get funding to do the raids.
Oh, yeah.
So they're in there having the meeting. They walk out, and lo and behold, there's a Barcelona chair. So I'm next to Tassie, I'm like, look, there's a Barcelona chair. And she's like, oh God, again, like, just, I don't even want to hear about the Barcelona chair.
Right. That's right. Yeah, I'm doing the same thing. There's like, except that's a fake. It's like, how do you know? Yeah. It's like the real Eames actually folds over on the armrest. Yeah. That one's...
Exactly.
That's funny.
So it's like it really like ruins your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny. It's so funny because like my boys are like, they're like, so what do you guys want to do? They're like, not architecture. Like, we want to do something completely the opposite of that. Yeah. So they're trying to get it to school for engineering.
Yeah. That's like my kids who's like, oh, is that the building that you did, Dad? I was like, well, I didn't build it. I designed it. She's like, oh, so you just build your computer and that's it? I'm like, yeah, the design. She's like, but who builds it? I was like, oh, I want to do that.
Yeah.
I'm like, thanks, kid.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's an important aspect of the architectural education. And you're saying you're never, like, nobody I talk to is disappointed with the education itself. They're sort of more disappointed with what happens
afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah, because we're not, you know. We're not taught those things about, yeah, you know, the money.
Well, I also think like part of it's like, I mean, how many of you guys really like know what it entailed to go to architecture school and actually become an architect? I didn't know. You told me that it was going to take me like 8 years to get a license or that I, and all that other crap. I'm like, no, thanks, man.
Yeah.
Let me even, take even the easier. Licensing, I don't think I understood that until I was like in third year or something. Like actually understand it.
Yeah.
Yeah. After I didn't get it until after I graduated either. You know?
Yeah. No, it's weird because I think the other end, personally, I think some people are aligned with me. It's like we're always trying to find the alternative to that. So it's like, in stupidly, like I would say, like, well, you don't need a license,
mm-hmm,
you just need to practice. I would always say that, and now I'm like, no, you probably should get your license.
So that's what
it
I was
just
saying,
helps out. It just gets it.
Yeah.
When was it like? I think in one of the times that I went back to like a lecture at Woodbury, I ran into Salvador. He's like, "Oh, so you got license?" Like, I would have never expected that from you.
Yeah.
I'm like, I know. I was like, me neither, man. But then I hit the real world. I was like, I should probably get licensed so I can do my own projects.
Exactly. So I don't know.
So are you thinking of like setting up a program of maybe like changing that mentality and at least like kids, introducing that to kids about licensing, about like, having your own business or like the other alternatives there are in architecture?
Yeah, I think so. I think that actually what you just brought up just put a lit up bulb in my head where you said, you know, the way you market it, architecture is not literally architecture, but it's actually, it has the possibilities of doing all these things.
It's almost like architecture needs a rebranding.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's right on. That's one thing. For me, it's this, because again, you know, when I went to OCC, this was in December, I went to OCC and like it was kind of shocking to see all these machines and all the things that they can kind of do. It's like, if you have two or three things, you could literally, you don't need a crew to build a house. Mm-hmm. You could literally have robots,
yeah,
and machines do it for you. And every day it's getting closer and closer where it's going to be pretty feasible to do it.
Yeah.
Right. It's like IKEA for the house.
Yeah.
Here's your house in two boxes.
Yeah, but if you have a robot and if you have this, I forgot what it's called, or if you have a company that ships parts for you, it's not really IKEA so much because you get to design whatever you want. They'll just mail it to you.
Yeah, that's kind of like the dream or the ideal of these, the robot, the 3D printer,
yeah,
that there will not, it's going away from standardization.
Right.
Because at that point, if you have a 3D printer, you can do any dimension, any size, any configuration. You're not limited by like, oh, I need to find the hex, the bolts that are exactly this size, or I need a, you know, 2x6 walls. It needs to be, you know, this.
Yeah. I mean, I forgot who was telling me that, you know, for Revit models are now the things that you submit for review for certain projects.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
no longer are they physical drawings.
Yeah. Wow, that's crazy. Like at the city or?
For some city and some federal projects.
Wow.
Yeah, because they probably want to sit around like, I mean, you just have to be a really good model maker. Make it legit from the
get-go. Yeah, but it's also because it's, right, the algorithm is embedded in the Revit model.
Yeah.
So all the data is super precise that's, mm-hmm, in there.
Right.
all the mistakes are precisely, you know, presented in the Revit model.
You can't
so
fake
they
it.
Can really, yeah, you can't fake it in that. So there, so there's a that's
one
the
thing
way
I do hate about Revit, though. Yeah, you can't fake things. You could to an extent, but it's hard.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, so it has to be tight.
Yeah, so that's why it's like, okay, just submit your model.
Yeah, Revit's getting intense with every like new release.
Yeah, so like if that opens up, and if education can kind of teach you, I guess, because in a weird way, it's like it's almost like, you know, like, you know, when certain softwares came out, like, you know, Photoshop or Illustrator, it's like anybody can be a graphic designer now. Mm-hmm. And so everybody's like, oh, yeah, I could totally do that. And when you start doing it, it's like, oh, I don't want to do this. let the graphic designer kind of do it. But in a weird way, the profession of graphic design is disappearing as well.
Yeah.
Because everybody can kind of do it. Or it's already, templates already there to kind of do it. I think with this, the same thing might potentially happen.
It's the Squarespace model. You know, you don't need to be a web graphic or a
web developer.
It's good enough to put your content out there.
Create a website. It's, yeah. Even us with the podcast, you know, I'm the one that's like uploads it, does everything. I don't need to hire anybody because I can go on YouTube and just, you know, look at some tutorials, mess up a few times, get it right.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's scary. Yeah. And then you're up there with like heavy competitors who have like heavy production of all these like other podcasts and you're sitting in your garage or whatever, you know? But yeah, this idea of robotics, it's pretty crazy because it is happening in all industries too. I think I saw.
Look at what's happening to recording studios. Yeah. You don't need them.
You don't.
Yeah.
Just a really good computer, good software, and good soundproofing. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, like in relationship to like recording, or in relationship to architecture, it's like, okay, so these are the things that you have to do. That's right. I don't like. That's kind of boring. Like, I just want to know the things that you do wrong. Like to, because in that I'm learning, and in that way, maybe something new can kind of come out of all these processes. So the best example of recording studio is the Rancho de la Luna, in the desert, in Joshua Tree. I mean, it's a house, right? Yeah. It's like it's not a perfect recording studio. Yeah. It's like, you know, like, was it two wrongs don't make a right? But like,
right. Yeah,
50 wrongs.
Right.
Something interesting is going to come out of that.
Right.
So I think for me, that's my model. That's my motto. It's like, whatever happens with technology.
Right.
It's like, I don't want to do the right things because,
Yeah. Yeah, you can get experimental in that sense with that recording studio.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you're not a fan of John Mayer, but
yeah.
One of his albums that he did, there was this house that he really liked the acoustics in. So essentially, you know, got some equipment and recorded all throughout the house. So you don't really need this designated space anymore with, you know, a built-in soundboard to get like a high quality studio album out.
Right.
Which I hope that doesn't happen in architecture. As long as if I can die still doing what I do right now, we're good.
But I guess another thing that kind of popped up in my mind with the whole robotics thing, do you think that's bad for different trades? For example, you know, I saw that... like certain like McDonald's restaurants in like Europe, in like Japan, I think, like they have no cashiers. You just go up to like a vending machine kind of thing, and you put your order, and then you just get it through like, you know, a thing that comes out of there.
Yeah,
which is kind of gross, but for example, you know, you talked about this. You submit your Revit model, and then it gets prefabricated, and you know, like, so that kind of cuts out like framers. That cuts out like, you know, like these other trades that are sort of essential to the industry.
Yeah. So that was when I went to OCC and they're just demonstrating this machine that, you know, pulled out the milled steel. There was a developer that was there as a kind of advisor as well, and he was saying like, well, how's that going to happen when you can't go to like Home Depot anymore and hire the hand help to construct your backyard? You know, it's a different material, it's a different system, and there, you know. The director there, she was basically saying, well, it's really not that difficult to kind of assemble. It's nuts and bolts. It's just, it's numbered. There's a, you know, there is a learning curve, but the trade can kind of change to kind of, to do it, at least for that machine at this moment right now. But maybe in the near future, it probably will be all automated.
Yeah.
So, that's a dilemma that we're going to, I mean, that's been happening for the past, I mean, I don't know, that's 30, all 40 years.
Like technology does too. I mean, I know it's not like an argument against it, but you know, when horses were still a thing, you know, look, there's a lot of jobs that were lost.
Yeah.
Like stables, you know,
yeah,
all those things.
Recently with coal, like the coal industry is kind of doing the same thing, right? Like they're losing a lot of jobs because nobody's using coal anymore.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, I think we're still in this moment that we're trying to figure it all out. So I just remember, I should be more precise with my references, but, you know, I read it somewhere where they talked about paper and how it took about 300 years because, you know, paper has to hold the ink, the paper, you know, because like they would try different types of combinations of fabrics and
porosities
and you know, the ink would spread or, you know, it would disappear the next day, right? So over a period of 300 years, it took to kind of perfect what paper is and what paper can do. And so within that, you know, 300 years, with technology, we've probably started maybe 50 years, maybe a little bit more. Maybe after World War II. That's when it kind of started. And so we're still in this kind of moment where we don't know what it is. We're just trying to figure it out. But it's happening pretty fast. Faster than the process it is to discover paper.
Yeah, and really the way it is right now, there's kind of two paths that I think. This is just me too, you know, reading stuff and seeing what's out there. But one is like decentralized. Everything, you know, everybody owns a 3D printer, everybody owns a robot, everybody owns all these things that you can build and make anything you want on your own.
Yeah.
And the other one is centralized. The Amazon does everything for you. Google, you know, it's your phone, it's your iPad, it's everything. So those are kind of like the two paths in front of us, kind of.
It is, and I think like that goes way beyond architecture, and it goes into that's like a societal thing, because I think it's a decision that we have to make. Either that we make it. My choice is decentralization, because if you have centralization, well, one is like you're limited by choices, but two, it starts to align with a kind of monolithic political social system. So that what that means is that ultimately one person can kind of control us all. Sorry, I'm getting too philosophical, but I think architecture falls into that kind of those two ends as well.
Yeah, it's going to have to...
It has to make a decision.
Make a decision, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting when you can order a house from Amazon. You know?
I think IKEA, you can... I want to say that they're going to start to do that.
Like little, like, what do they call it, guest houses? Or
I think so.
I mean, Sears famously had that program that you could order a house from Sears.
Yeah.
It didn't last for long.
Yeah.
And only, you know, it's one of those things where, like, it's limited models. The plot of land needs to be, like...
I still think that people like the idea of custom, like it's made for you. So I think that's, like, the one saving grace right now. Like, I think people don't like, you know, I don't want you to be driving the exact same car that I'm driving. Like, I want to feel special. Like, I have something that was built for me.
Limited edition.
Know. Maybe I'm just...
A lot of people do like that, but a lot of people don't. A lot of people don't care. They just want, you know, like something.
Yeah, a lot of people don't care.
They just don't care. They just want to live in a box and that's it, as long as it's cheap or, you know. Right. But yeah, like, I think like those type of people, it's more people, you know, with money and they have taste and, you know, this and that. And
well, poor people don't have taste.
That's not what I mean. Yeah, and it could turn into like a status thing too, because if we... You know, I know you, Miguel, and like me as well, we kind of follow fashion a lot, and how, like, sure, if you go to like a Nike store, you'll find like all this stuff. But then if you go online and you look at what like special releases that are only in Japan or like only in limited amounts, and those are like the coveted things, and those are the ones that are done in collaborations with like designers, where like Nike gets together with like some other designer and they release, you know.
So it's going back to like you need to be educated in that for you to even care.
Yeah.
Like if you don't know, it's like okay, it's just a shirt, you know.
Yeah, but it's so as again, and so the other thing too is that people in general don't want to make decisions, right? So it's like you're going to the supermarket, you see like 50 cereal boxes, like oh god, which one am I going to choose? Or like you get a pair of jeans, and it's like, which one do you choose? Like there's, you go to Levi's, it's like there's so many different types.
Table right? cut, low waist.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're in this world where it's like it's customization, but it's almost overwhelming too.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're overwhelmed with like, what are you gonna do? So like I was reading this other segment podcast where they were talking about. If you were in a company and, you know, they're offering you 401k options, the ones where they gave you like 50 or more different options. Did you read that one? Versus the one that offers you like 4 or 2 or 1. People tended to do the 4, 2, 1 because it's just easy. It's like done. I don't want to think about it.
People were more likely to engage with the program with the 401k program when it was limited.
Yeah.
Then when it was like, do anything you want.
Yeah. But the thing that I learned from that too was that in the end, the person that was arguing for it said that if you just take the time to learn through what each one is doing, in the end, it's going to be best for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
more choices is ultimately better. But it's what you're saying that they're. For those that are not like interested in knowing, doing the research and like doing all that stuff, you know, they're overwhelmed by the decisions that you need to make.
Yeah. Basically. So then that could be the role of the architect.
Yeah.
Like we're the guide to help you towards, and I think it's always been that way.
Right.
In a sense.
But I think it, in a weird way, the architect needs to be even more present than ever.
Yeah.
Right.
Because you're going through this mess of making decisions.
Yeah, it's like the, like Abel was saying, like it's almost the psychology of it. Like he's saying in the fashion industry, like less choices, like the limited stuff. Even if you're not that educated in the design, like for example, there's that brand Supreme, and which I hate, but and they did a collaboration with Louis Vuitton, the first one they did, and it was just a sweater, a red sweater, hoodie with that Supreme logo on it and the Louis Vuitton pattern on it. I think they made 200. People didn't even know, like, you know, like didn't know Louis Vuitton, they just knew Supreme. They were just lining up, and like I think the sweaters were for like $1,200 each. They only made 200, resells for like 10-12 grand right now.
Jeez.
And it's like you're just telling these people what to do, and just you telling them, like, they're sort of the,
well, that's the centralized, you know, Supreme will be
like the
we're gonna let Supreme tell
dictate
us what's
good, what's
taste.
Cool.
Exactly.
And yeah, and I think when people just get that one choice and everybody's telling them, yeah, this is it, and then I don't know, it's like it's a really interesting concept. I don't know who would want that though. So another question I had for you, I know it's getting long, but
sorry,
man,
my fault.
No, it's great. I we don't want to like keep you here too long if you can't stay, but I just want to, I know you touch, you know, you play music and you do all these other things. I know you do the soapbox stuff with your kids. I mean, I really like that. That's really cool. How did you get into that kind of?
The music thing was through my name. And so here's the other thing. I think, it's like something that we don't do anymore. It's like actually go out and meet your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like and what's nice about this neighborhood, some people don't. No matter where you live, you don't. Some other people are out. Yeah.
You were just telling me.
Yeah, I know. Four houses down. I've never even seen you. So the other thing is being able to talk to your neighbors. And I think where I grew up was suburbia. No one wanted to talk to each other. Here in this neighborhood, at least in general, they're a little more friendlier and they want to talk to you. So I think that's how I was able to get my outlets, was actually talking to people in the neighborhood. So like playing music ended up being the neighbor who just plays drums, and I hadn't played music in over, 20 years. I didn't even touch a guitar. He's like, "Why don't you come out and jam out with us one time?" Okay. I played, and I couldn't play guitar. But of course, when you go to a jam session, everybody's a guitarist. So, like, they gave me there's the bass. I'll play the bass just this time around. Picked up the bass. I was like, oh, wow, this is so much fun. Like, I had so much fun. So that was the music outlet. The Soapbox Derbies that we lived were one long time ago, before the boys were born, we were walking around the neighborhood. We walked, turned the corner, and there's all these people, and they're having kids run down the hill. I'm like, that is awesome. So, I ended up talking to them when the boys were ready to start racing. Like, yeah, okay, you want to race? Great. We'll sign you up. Hey, you want to be a committee member too? Okay. they kind of forced me into it, but I got to do that as well. So I think, like, you just got to – you don't have to go too far, but yeah. It's there. It's like I always say, is like we're super intelligent, and we always tend to think things like 7 steps ahead. But we're never looking at the stuff that's like right in front of our nose.
Dude, that's like, me right now. That's like my life. I'm just like, I'm so focused like out there that I'm like missing everything.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I try. We always do that. So I try to see like what's around me, what's in front of me. And those two things, it's like what's really cool. It's like I get to be part of the neighborhood too because
that's
of that.
That's great.
So, and then, you talk to people around here and like so there's been events at Bread and Salt that I've been able, I just help out because I just want to help out friends and neighbors and stuff. So,
yeah, I'm working on that too, getting more involved too with the neighborhoods and everything. But it's hard. Yeah, I bring up the soapbox because when I was a kid, I saw one and I really wanted to do it, and I think I brought it out to my mom, and Mexican family, she's like, "You're gonna break your head. You're gonna die. You're gonna do this and that." And like, she never let me do it. And I'm like, I've always wanted to like at least like see those, and I know they you saw them here right in Sherman Heights. They would go down the hill, that's cool.
It's really cool. I think I'm going to put a plug in for the Soapbox Derby. So the cool thing about it is that we're the only organization in the United States where it's free for the kids.
Oh wow, nice!
They don't have to buy a car.
Oh cool!
They don't have to pay for the races. Nice. We raise the money to kind of do that. It's because a car is about $800. Wow. A kit. And you have to buy the kit because it's all rules and regulations. And
there's a code for it.
There's a code for it. And you think about kids in this neighborhood, there's no way that they can afford to do that. So when I found that out, I was like, that's awesome. Like, how can I help out? How can be a part of it? Because you guys let my kids ride for free. At least let me do something in return.
That's great.
So that kind of grew out of that relationship.
That's cool.
Yeah. And as far as time, like, what would you say? How do you find it? Because I know you're like super busy with the school now, and
I have no idea. That's a bad question to ask.
Yeah, because I mean, how do you balance all that out? You know, like spending time with the kids, and like doing the music, the soapbox, all of that. Or do you even try? You just kind of let it happen.
Well, it's like I make time. I think it's this thing about like you have to make the decision to kind of make the time to do it.
Just like step away from the work and just.
Yeah. So like it was funny because with everything that was happening at school, band practice was kind of skipping a couple times, and it was weird because I had different emotionally. Like this is so weird. It's true. It sounds weird, but it's true. Like emotionally, physically, I was just like feeling out of it. And so I told my friend, my neighbors, like, "Hey, I got to practice. Like, we're going to make the time." He's like, "But you're busy." "No, let's just do it." And we did it. And because I did it, it made me a better teacher, made me a better like person.
Yeah.
It's like you need it.
Yeah.
I need to do those things. Like the Soapbox Derby, like we had our first meeting this morning. That's why I came over here. Nobody wants to do it. Like even the head person, he's like, "I'd rather just stay at home, to be honest." But like when you're done 6 months later and you see the kids and they're so happy, Joe, yeah, it's totally worth it.
Yeah,
it's so worth it. It's so much, and it's fun. It's like, you know,
yeah.
I like, so like this other thing about Creative Outlet, like I do, I design all the posters for the races for every year.
Yeah.
And they're like, Jose, we just need this information. It's like, okay. And I just go gangbusters. That's the fun part. Yeah, it's the fun part. So in a weird way, it's like, selfishly, like I get to do things that like normally I wouldn't do. Yeah. So
nice.
You make time. I guess that's what I'm trying to, you should make the time to do those things. Because, yeah, otherwise the world will just like...
Yeah, it just becomes, it's not fun anymore. It's not. Yeah.
I think you just, and this is something that I've kind of learned the hard way, because I was always like very, I'm like, oh, like I gotta, you know, work every single second has to be towards school.
Yeah.
But you need those outlets. Like there's, if not, you get burned out.
Yeah.
Like, and you're also not as
productive.
Productive. Yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah, I'm sorry, but there's things bigger in life than architecture. I should, in this pod, you know, there's going to be people, and probably the next one might disagree with me completely. But I think, like, and for me, that was a realization when my kids were born. Like, it's like, before that, it was all about architecture. And then when they were born, it was like, what? Like, what was I thinking? Like, no, there's things way more important than that. So... yeah, you got to give it perspective, absolutely, in this profession. Otherwise, it'll just, I don't know, it can eat you up. It can really eat you up fast.
I mean, I should probably ask this like to my doctor instead of you, but do you just feel tired all the time? I feel tired all the time. Like, anything that I do, I'm just like, ugh, just dragging my feet.
Yeah, for me, it goes in waves. So, like, this break, this winter break, was awesome. Like, it was literally... the first break where I really appreciated every single day, and it was just nice so that by the end of it I wasn't even thinking about school anymore. It was just like, it was so amazing. And then the next day I had to go back, so it's like but it felt good. Like I felt like it was truly a break, you know. I was talking about earlier, like it's always in the back of your mind. It was the first time in years where it's like I was able to kind of say I wasn't even thinking about it.
Yeah, that's great.
For 1-2 days. Like, it was awesome.
It's a true vacation right there.
It was a true vacation, yeah. And we didn't have to go anywhere.
So something that I always ask our guests is, what advice would you give, like, a person who's trying to go into architecture school? Like, a first-year kid or somebody... I mean, at least for us, like, we went back to architecture school older, you know? I was 25 when I went back to architecture school. Maybe somebody at that age, or maybe somebody who, you know, is getting out of high school, like, what advice would you give them if they're thinking into, like, getting in into this career?
I think for me, it's just, I think it's, and I don't know, I used to say this, but I don't think I kind of agree with it anymore. I used to say that, you know, architecture is a lifestyle.
Uh-huh.
It's more than a profession. I think that's still kind of true, but I want to stop that. I think, you know, because I think it shouldn't be. I mean, it is because you can talk about it. There's, you know, how you were talking about what you were saying earlier. There's so many ways that it relates to other things that it's so easy to get caught up into the theory, into the practice of architecture. But I would say at the same time, you got to limit it, give yourself a bigger perspective in that sense. I think for me, what architecture does is it gives you this ability to see things differently. Mm-hmm. Fundamentally, whether you're going to stick with architecture or not, it's going to make you see the world. And the moment that I took my studio courses, the moment that I took, heard those conversations from my instructors, I can't go back. Like, yeah, it's just, you see, yeah, you're hooked. And you see,
you
the
can't unsee it.
You can't unsee it. You can't, as much as hard. And believe me, I've tried. You can't. But that's kind of cool. Like, because it's like, it's almost like a secret society. It's like, we can have conversations about that you go outside the house, this house, and it gets pretty difficult to explain the same things that you talked about in here.
I think you nailed it, because at least for me, that's how, like, subconsciously that's how it became. Even Hector makes fun of me. Like, I went into the architecture not, you know, like I'm just gonna, you know, just gonna get a job, this and that. And then as that evolved in my, I guess, career, my, you know, Hector always talks, as my jeans started getting, like, tighter.
Like, you know, everything gets black.
Everything gets black. Yeah, like, it just becomes lifestyle. Yeah. And you can't help it.
Yeah.
You know, it just kind of swallows you. I mean, if you really wanted to. Because there are some people, some friends who are very good at balancing it. But a lot of us just, they just swallow you, you know?
Yeah, and so, like, and I don't know, you know, it goes into this question whether that's a good or bad thing, because, like, I know people, too, that are in firms, and in firms for years, and they treat it like a job. I go to work, do my thing, come back home, and then I do my tasks. I don't ask questions, I just do it, you know, and I think that's, I appreciate that, and I understand that. To me,
that's
that.
Crazy.
Right? Yeah. I appreciate it, like, because someone needs to get stuff done, right? Like, someone needs to build something. So I come to my point of view, my life, moment in my life, I appreciate that. But I can't do that. There's no way that I can, that I wouldn't be happy.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, I want to be a happy person.
Yeah.
I think architecture is so much fun. Yeah. That moment where you're kind of making stuff, and like you're discovering things and you're researching things, and like, I don't know if it is for you guys, but if I practice design enough and I get into these modes, like I can like make pretty amazing things pretty fast.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, I just did that. That's so cool. And then there's moments where there's a gap where I don't design or think about it or look at it for a couple months or even a year, and another project comes in, and it's almost like not starting from scratch, but it takes a little bit of time to get myself into gear to kind of get things going and kind of keep moving. I love those moments where it's like from this to my hands, from my head to my hands, and or typing or on the mouse or whatever, or making something, and like, you know, like beforehand the moves you're gonna make, like it, you know, the magic's going to happen.
I think I think I've told you guys about this, but it's, I think what you're experiencing, it's called, they're calling it like a flow state.
Yeah, exactly.
And what it is that if you look at a graph, like where the x-axis, x and y-axis, the x-axis is like your ability to do the task, whatever it is, and the y is how difficult it is. And it's like, they have to be in harmony. Because if it's too hard to do, and you don't know, like, if I want to bake, like, a wedding cake, that's too hard. I'm going to get frustrated. It's not going to work.
Right.
But if I, you know, if I'm doing something that I'm, where it's like that perfect symmetry where my skill matches the difficulty, that's when you get those moments.
Yeah.
And it applies to, like, music.
Yeah.
I know for me, like basketball, like, yeah, getting into like that groove where like, yeah, you're making the moves, you know, you're like ahead of it, kind of. It's hard to explain.
It's just fluid. It's just like, yeah, fluid. Everything's just snapping into place.
Yeah. It's so much fun.
Yeah, that's...
And I think, you know, to be at a place where you're just not taking advantage of it, it's kind of a shame. I guess for me, for some people, I appreciate it, and I really appreciate them that have that ability to kind of just shut things off. But I don't know. I'm still learning how to do that. I don't think I ever will.
I think the mistake that a lot of us make is kind of like, that's like the drug, and you're always like seeking the next high.
Yeah.
And we go to the dark path of like when it starts affecting relationships and like, you know, where it's like you're spending too much time.
Yeah, that's the other extreme.
That's the other extreme, because I know what you're saying about the people who just do the task and they just go home. That's kind of like one end, and like, you know, the other end, it's the opposite where you're just trying to get that moment again and again.
And then there's like, I don't know, for me at least, like I would love to do competitions all the time. So on top of like having a full-time job and then doing real side work on real projects, and like try to do what I like to do, which is like photo bashing and creating these images and doing competitions, that a conflict with my wife is no longer worth it. Like, what are you doing this weekend? I'm just working on this image. For what? For yourself? I'm like, yeah. I mean, this is... Uh-uh. I mean, I'm trying to create a series, babe, so that, you know, like... It's like, are you getting paid for that? It's like, absolutely, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you have gone through that, but that's just another, thing where, like... It's something that's fulfilling to me. You know, like, when I see, when I start from scratch on an image and I start, like, photobatching and the end product, I'm like, oh, that looks sick, you know?
Yeah. To don't me, be like, so selfish.
I know. Right? So that balance too gets tough.
Yeah, but like I don't know, like raising kids. Like for me, it's like you take. It's so weird. It's like because they were born like right after we graduated from graduate school, and it's like literally the same skills that I taught were being applied to like how to like. Be up, you know, all night. Oh, yeah. Right? Change diapers, feeding, all that stuff. So
you had the endurance for it.
Yeah, totally. I was like, yeah, I got this. This is easy.
Been up for 3 days, no problem.
But I think also, too, as they're growing up, and like, what's been really cool with them is that we, like, I've been kind of forcing them these kind of theoretical archy talk conversations. And so, like, they kind of understand now. And so we can have these conversations. Every once in a while. Not so much because they're like, come on, like, no, really? Like, no. Like, I don't want to do that.
That's funny.
It's funny.
How old are your kids now? Yeah.
They're going to be 17 in March.
Wow. They're almost up to college.
Yeah, so we're looking at schools.
That's gnarly.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Wow. So I don't know. We're going to be the overprotective parents.
That's crazy. They're like toddlers when we started school, but I guess
they were probably like 10 or 12.
I guess 2010.
Oh, yeah, 2010. No,
like
yeah,
8 years ago, I guess.
Yeah, so they were like 9, 10.
Yeah, so I guess we're going to get to some of these questions, but I mean, this one's kind of interesting. I mean, you still have a little bit of time, right?
What time is it?
It's almost 2:30.
2:30? Yeah. Give me like. Probably like 20 minutes.
Okay. I just have a couple more and that's it. This one's did you have a favorite studio in school? Like not as a group of people, but that you taught, that like maybe the urban studio,
like topic studios.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Well, the first studio that I taught was the urban studio because I was like the landscape architect dude, and they're like, well, where can we put them in the architecture? Let's put them in the urban design. So I think that makes sense. Like I really like that, you know, because it's dealing with the scale of the city. It is more about landscape than it is about the building itself. So personally, it's fun for me to talk about that. That's kind of like my expertise, and I kind of put that in there. For some reason, for me, the first and second year, they're really challenging for me. And I think over time what's happened to me is that, you know, like in the courses, it's like a lot of the instructors would say, first do this, then do that, blah, 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 take everything step by step, poof, you get this project. Mm-hmm. And for me, what I was noticing, this is just me, my personal observations. I think if you interview other people, they would disagree. This is just my personal take. Is that over time, as you got kind of later into the curriculum, it got really difficult for students to think on their own. They were so kind of used to having the instructor tell them step by step how to do. So the moment that they hit thesis, I was like, well, what do I do? How do I start this thing when, you know, like you always told me what to do. So what I've been trying to do now, and so, sorry, it's a long-winded way, but I'm trying to relate it back to like the ones that I'm interested in. I have a harder time dealing with the first and second year because it is kind of more, and it should be, I think, more formulaic and like first do this, da-da-da-da-da. But like what interests me more is kind of like thesis. So I think like it's not so much the types of classes, it's just more at the later end where it's like you guys already have those skills developed. Yeah. And it's like me more, not so much a teacher, but more like a mentor, like a guide. And like, how, it's not like, I don't want you to do these things. It's like, for me, it's like, how can I help you get to the things and the stuff that you want to talk about or deal with.
Yeah.
So that by the end, the time you graduate, it's like you have skills, and that's one end, but you also have somewhat of an agenda of like, am I going to approach architecture?
Yeah.
What's my personal take on it? That's all I want to do. Mm-hmm. If I can do those things, then hopefully I did a good job. It's tough.
Yeah,
I
think, that is tough.
I think I would say the school does a good job of setting those students that already have the ability to do that. It's good because the school's so like, when you know what you want to do, there's not really any obstacles.
Exactly.
But for those students that it needs to be like, that skill needs to be like brought out of them, I would say the school's kind of lacking.
Yeah.
Because I definitely saw students having that difficulty in thesis, whereas like me, I had a blast. Like
yeah,
I
just because did you knew what
whatever,
you wanted
yeah,
to do.
I just did That's whatever easy. I wanted to do.
Yeah. But I would say for most of the students, it's just my observation, is that most of them don't know how to do that. Because and I think a lot of it's like they've been so used, this is just my observations, that they're so used to being told what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that was mine. That's why I like thesis, because it's kind of a challenge. It's like, how can I, that's the last thing that we can do, is like, how can I give them their own 2 feet to kind of stand on, so that then they can be critical and come up with those kind of concepts on their own.
Yeah. I think for me, the hardest thing about kind of like that period of time, from what I remember, was like the criticism. I know we had a lot of people come in and kind of, I don't know if you remember, we had like at the middle, was it at the middle where we had like, when we were trying to pick our mentors or our advisors, and we had like different people come and talk to us about our board and our project and stuff. And I guess when I get too many, this is just personal.
Yeah. Too much feedback.
Like I get a little
overwhelmed.
It's a little overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed that too.
Yeah.
So what I was trying to do, so I learned from that. I think that's a good point. That was an opportunity that I made. So what I was doing with the thesis prep, was the complete opposite. So I get a jury, and I only get like maybe 2-3 other people. We would meet in the meet room. Nobody else was there. You would come in with your book and you would present the book, and so that it's just more focused.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was that I just wanted it, and I didn't want it to be like a you up on the wall, people shooting you down. But more of like, how can we make it like a conversation?
Yeah.
How can we make it so that we're here to help you?
Yeah.
And have a like this is the perfect environment to have critiques and reviews, right? It's like, nothing's right or wrong. It's just, let's just talk it through and figure it out.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been trying to do personally. Whether that works or not, that's a whole another story.
I think that would have been super beneficial for me, because just personally on a level, I know like when I'm up on the wall and there's other things happening, like I get a little distracted, like the background noises.
Totally.
I get a little, like if something like raises their voice over there, I'm like, like a dog,
Me too.
It's just like, it's a little like overwhelming, but
yeah.
I mean, I think that's a good route that you're going like that, because you go in one room, you talk to 2 or 3 people just like this, and it becomes less stressful and more focused.
Exactly.
Yeah, because for me that was really hard, and I mean, I appreciate I wanted my advisor. I got the advisor I wanted, and I think he guided me well. But I wish I would have had more of that type of conversation.
Yeah. So that I mean, when I'm teaching, I'm not teaching that right now. But when I did, that's what I was learning. That's what I was trying to do. And then the other thing that was related to that is then, if I'm teaching earlier courses, what I would usually do is then I would start that. Like now what I'm trying to do is even in studio, like I'll do the first, do the ba ba ba, the ba ba ba, the first part. And then towards the end, I just kind of let go. And like, it's on you. And like, I'm just here to have conversations with you. We can talk about stuff, but it's all on you at the end. So don't forget the stuff that we talked about earlier in the semester. And then that's hard, because it's like, you're just there. It's like, I know. It's like, you're there week to week, and you're like, I forgot what happened last week. Yeah. Like, how am I going to know what's happening now? So, I don't know. And I think that's a way for me too, personally, like to keep this thing going. Because yeah. I think, it, as in teaching, as with everything else, you can get into a rut pretty quick. Yeah, so you have to keep it fresh.
Keep and it keep together. It moving.
Otherwise, it's like, I don't want to be the same. I don't want to be teaching the same stuff.
Yeah, year after year after year. Yeah, that's not.
Yeah. So, yeah, that I guess that's just me.
That's good. Any other questions?
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, well, thank you for being here. For
yeah, out. No, that was fun.
That was a good conversation. It flew by, but it's been like 2.5 hours.
I know. I thought, because I told him, so talk about, that's why I was like, oh, I should better go, because personal time, like, I was like, oh, yeah, you know, because the boys are having a birthday party. They went somewhere and dropped them off. At, like, don't worry. It's only going to be an hour. I'll be right back.
Oh, shit.